You'll see in this preface here that they're reminding us of some of the details again that we brought up a number of times about where religion comes from.
Paper 103, The Reality of Religious Experience. All of man's truly religious reactions are sponsored by the early ministry of the Adjutant of Worship and are censored by the Adjutant of Wisdom. Man's first supermind endowment is that of personality encirclement in the Holy Spirit of the universe creative spirit. And long before either the bestowals of the divine sons or the universal bestowal of the adjusters, this influence functions to enlarge man's viewpoint of ethics, religion, and spirituality. Subsequent to the bestowals of the paradise sons, the liberated spirit of truth makes mighty contributions to the enlargement of the human capacity to perceive religious truths. As evolution advances on an inhabited world, the thought adjusters increasingly participate in the development of the higher types of human religious insight. The thought adjuster is the cosmic window through which the finite creature may faith glimpse the certainties and divinities of limitless deity, the universal Father.
Okay, they're pointing out again. It all starts out in a very natural fashion. There is no obvious transition suddenly. It all grows very smoothly up through the adjutants until you finally get to the sixth adjutant, you know, and smoothly you go into the sixth, and that now you have, you know, that zeal, that energy of zeal that's your religious impulse, you know, and it smoothly flows into the seventh, and you begin to get some wisdom to put a governor on that zeal a little bit, like they're pointing out. And of course, the instant that the seventh adjutant engages, the Holy Spirit circuits, and you notice how they worded that, just like I was saying before, personality encirclement in the Holy Spirit of the universe creative spirit. The only way your personality can be encircuited is if there's spirit energy, you know, spirit substance for it to pattern, to engage. It's a simultaneous phenomenon that you are encircuited in the spirit energy, the Holy Spirit, and then upon that substrate, pattern can flow. So there's this, you know, that bestowal of personality, you know, quote unquote, you know, the first actualization of that personality potential that's been waiting, you know, since the infinite past. You know, or not the eternal past, excuse me, the eternal past, for this Holy Spirit encirclement moment to grab on into, you know, to lock onto time and space and you know, and actualize for the first time. See, you, there's the hand of the mother and the hand of the father are working together very seamlessly there. There's not a lot of places where they, you know, say it, you know, so clearly, you know, to remind you of how the Holy Spirit and the personality are working very intimately together like that. But see, all that phenomenon, it was right there with Andon and Fonta a million years ago, you know, has a, you know, seemingly natural character where you're not watching and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, where did that come from? So it seems all very natural. If you aren't aware, you know, that mind and spirit have to have a source other than carbon atoms, you know, you can rationalize, you know, you could, and of course many do, rationalize that's, you know, there's nothing profound going on there. That's just the character of a complex brain like humans have. It all seems natural. But, you know, if you talk to the apostles on the day of Pentecost, they'll tell you, whoa, that's not natural. Now, all of a sudden, you know, there was this incredible new character that, you know, they could tell from personal experience, you know, didn't well up from within them. That was an external engagement that they suddenly have with the Spirit of Truth and the thought adjusters. That ability to engage the thought adjusters with that enhanced connectivity of the Spirit of Truth. That's a definite suddenly. You'll see as we read the rest of it, you know, why they went back and reminded you of that whole thing, you know, so that you can again appreciate why we have the different types of religious character that we do. All right.
The religious tendencies of the human races are innate. They are universally manifested and have an apparently natural origin. Primitive religions are always evolutionary in their genesis. As natural religious experience continues to progress, periodic revelations of truth punctuate the otherwise slow-moving course of planetary evolution. On Urantia today, there are four kinds of religion. 1. Natural or evolutionary religion. 2. Supernatural or revelatory religion. 3. Practical or current religion, varying degrees of the admixture of natural and supernatural religions. 4. Philosophic religions, man-made or philosophically thought-out theological doctrines and reason-created religions.
Okay, so, like they're pointing out, yeah, most of what you have today in terms of current religion is not purely natural or purely revelatory. It's some mixture. Yeah, there's little isolated pockets of one and two, but nothing very extensive. Anything that has any real extent is bound to be, you know, to represent a blended phenomenon. Blended and blending, you know, still blending. And then, you know, as soon as we started getting a little more sophisticated in our ability to think about things, you know, we started to see more of number four cropping up. You know, you even have these creations from a reasoned and intellectual perspective, a rationalization perspective, that, you know, are so-called religions, really, because when you boil it right down, there isn't really a God there. There's some exalted something or other, you know, that isn't really the personal God. And so in that number four, a lot of pretty fuzzy things, especially over, well, let's see, probably the last 200 years, say, or so, you've gotten a whole bunch of isms that have been fabricated, kind of fit into number four there. You know, you will always be befogged by much thinking. Famous line of Jesus and Gannett in Alexandria. The only thing that brings clarity is cosmic insight. Thinking compounded by more thinking, with more thinking piled on top of that, and, you know, and a cherry, is just not going to get you anything but just a big, confused mess. Because you're invariably, see, all you're doing, you know, when you're just, you know, using the second adjutant to connect things together, you know, you're going around in a tangled ball of twine inside your subjective consciousness. You know, so there's no way that's going to be clear by definition. See, it wraps back on itself. The only solution to that is to open up that window. You noticed how they use that beautiful, you know, we've used the personality gives you the ability to have a faith grasp. And we've talked about that image a lot, that's really helpful, you know, that helps to create this fact, you know, the literalness of this fact, the fact of the experience. But notice how they added another dimension to that, calling it a faith glimpse. You know, we've already kind of talked about the three cosmic intuitions as kind of windows into the cosmos. Here they're reminding you, you bring in the adjuster, and now you have a window to the infinity and absoluteness of the first source. So you can really have an incredible depth that you can begin to try to plumb in those, what started out as these three windows that, you know, you were trying to push a little bit deeper into the cosmos. The adjuster comes in, and it's like, well, let's just throw back the shutters here and, you know, go for it. I can really catalyze this process of deepening your insight for you. You know, the adjuster will adjust things so that you can see more deeply than you ever could, you know, more deeply logical, more deeply moral, and more truly, you know, spiritually deep, all the way to infinity. All right, someone want to do a first section here?
1. Philosophy of religion. The unity of religious experience among a social or racial group derives from the identical nature of the God fragment indwelling the individual. It is this divine in man that gives origin to his unselfish interest in the welfare of other men. But since personality is unique, no two mortals being alike, it inevitably follows that no two human beings can similarly interpret the leadings and urgings of the spirit of divinity which lives within their minds. A group of mortals can experience spiritual unity, but they can never attain philosophic uniformity. And this diversity of the interpretation of religious thought and experience is shown by the fact that 20th century theologians and philosophers have formulated upward of 500 different definitions of religion. In reality, every human being defines religion in the terms of his own experiential interpretation of the divine impulses emanating from the God spirit that indwells him. And therefore, must such an interpretation be unique and wholly different from the religious philosophy of all other human beings. When one mortal is in full agreement with the religious philosophy of a fellow mortal, that phenomenon indicates that these two beings have had a similar religious experience, touching the matters concerned in their similarity of philosophic religious interpretation.
Okay, so let's pause and ingest those first two paragraphs. You're going along, and they're pointing out to you have an absolutely unique personality. So there's really ultimately no way that you can share that with anyone. Your personality is absolutely unique. And then they turn right around in this second sentence, and what do they say? When one mortal is in full agreement with the religious philosophy of a fellow mortal, you're going, well, what? Wait a minute. I thought you just said that you couldn't be in full agreement. Yeah, but just let's go back. What were we just talking about previously? This whole difference between self and personality. You know, and your self starts out as a wholly sanghic phenomenon. You know, and then you're trying to bring in some personality to inform and upstep that self. And we all know that it's sad to record that so few persons are taking delight in cultivating more personal character. They're mostly just riding the inertia of that initial gift of grace that all seemed wholly natural, like we were just pointing out. And so, because of that, you know, you do have this. You know, we can get people to pool into pretty large groups. Now, if the group gets too large, you start to notice that it has subdivisions based upon differences of, you know, amongst selves because of genetic differences. You know, like whether or not, you know, your particular self has an initial bias towards material pragmatism or an initial bias towards spiritual idealism. That one often creates two subgroups of selves, you know, and all the other different things. You know, we all know that, I mean, it's so literally genetic that you can just look at the shape of someone's face or body a lot, and you can understand a lot about how they think about things. Because that whole initial sanghic-based self, that whole initial adjutant mind self is tuned to your genetics. It can't be any other way. There better be a relationship between that initial way your initial temperament, that initial way you think about things, and the way you look. You know, or this just wouldn't be logical. This is the way it is. You know, it just has to be that way. So you get a bunch of people of a similar genetic character, and you know, they can pretty easily pool together, you know, in an organized religious expression. You know, and find that they're pretty much in full agreement on this religious philosophy thing. And again, notice how they carefully say philosophy. Because again, when we're talking about self, we're talking more about mind. We're talking about personality, we're talking about spirit. Theology is philosophy. It's a mindal phenomenon. Science, philosophy, religion, matter, mind, spirit. They're doing the same thing again, you know, as they did previously. They're giving you a sense of how we could all challenge ourselves if we took more delight in being persons as opposed to just riding our initial inertia of self. We could really become these incredible points of clarity, like we were just pointing out, instead of having a certain befogged nature and looking for others that have a similar befogged nature and pooling together in groups. It's like, well, if you have enough people to think like that, it must not be befogged. It must be clear. If you can, you know, stop limiting yourself to the ignorance of others, break out of that, you know, and begin to take the light, you know, and having that courageous and independent cosmic thinking, you know, you're going to have a more and more independent and personal religious consciousness. Just think how much more wonderful it would be if when we engaged others, especially if our motivation is, you know, I'm really interested in how you see things. What is your faith glimpse of the certainties and divinities of a limitless deity? Can you try to describe them to me? I know I'll never be able to see that, and I'm really curious. I know it's going to be impossible for you to give me very much, but try. I'd love to hear, you know, what it looks like to you. What does the Father look like to you? Because only you can see that. If we got together with that, where what you were trying to be multicultural about was actually personality as opposed to self. Because there is no ability. I'm not curious at all about what your befogged perspective is. I don't care. And you don't care what my befogged perspective is. You see, and that's one of those fallacies that's in, you know, we know that fallacy is in play. It's because you have this initial notion, see, this vague sense that there's some value in engaging another person. But when you don't recognize the difference between person and self, you try to somehow realize that potential that you sense with self. And that's when you get, you know, like the bumper sticker, you know, that has the word coexist with, you know, all the different religious symbols, you know, used to spell it. No, that's a whole bunch of befogged perspectives. And you glom them together and you just get a great big gobbledygook befogged perspective. It doesn't get you anywhere. Every one of those parts needs to right itself to the cosmos. And the moment it does, you'll discover that there's a tendency for all the symbols to be alike. Because they're beginning to see, you know, just like they pointed out. Notice what they pointed out at the beginning here. Because we all have adjusters, you know, they're not persons. Matter of fact, as virgin adjusters, they're absolutely identical in character. And so, definitely in our immature state, where we're maybe glimpsing the skin of your adjuster, you're not penetrating any depth of your adjuster, it's going to be virgin-like in character. It's going to be identical across the board. We're all going to see the same thing there, and that's what they're pointing out. The unity of religious experience among a social or racial group derives from the identical, not similar, identical nature of the God fragment indwelling the individual. As we begin to actually look up and look into the depth of the cosmos, there's this twofold character going on. There is this incredible gift of unity potential that's right there that we can begin to engage and begin to see a commonality that would probably lead to us all adopting the same symbols because we'd be trying to symbolize the unity that we jointly see. That's what religion is supposed to be attempting to do. Be a system of ideals, not a system of ideas. And there's a potential for commonality of clarity of ideals because of the adjuster, like they're trying to point out. That unity consciousness catalyzer, you know, and clarifier that is the adjuster. And then in that context of an actual means to be one, we can begin to realize our personality uniqueness and share that. I can't take possession of your personal religious experience, but I can augment my whole understanding of mine by challenging myself to appreciate what you see of the first source. What only you can see of the first source. A true fellowship, see? Both the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth are literal spirit ministries so that your spirit pattern, your personality can engage them. But they're circuits or presences, whichever way you want to think about them. They're not fragments. They're not this incredible example of absolute focus of unity that is the adjuster. Like we were talking before, that's the incredible thing that the adjuster brings in to this threefold divine gift, you know, this threefold objective gift. It's not just more unity. It's unity and individuality. Because where does it come from? It comes from that which is prior to the separation into individuality and unity, into matter and spirit, energy and spirit. It's not just pure spirit. In part, you can, you know, abstractly think of it as pure spirit. It can engage all that is spirit, but it's also pure energy. So it can bring focus, it can bring individuality into the midst of the greatest unity. That's the glory that is the adjuster. You know, that it's individuality and unity. You start out with individuality, you bring in some unity, and then you get the absolute example of what it will look like when you absolutely harmonize those two starting grips on the parallelism of the cosmos, the individuality and unity. They just pointed out here, the perfect soul of infinite supremacy. We have our soul being woven, you know, the material and the spiritual being woven in relationship to the finite of supremacy, or moving towards that along with the supreme. But how much greater, how much easier will it be to do that initial task of the finite if you can see not just to the complete point, the supremacy point, not just to the ultimate point beyond that, but all the way to the infinite absolute point of what harmony looks like? How much is that going to catalyze this process? Like I was just saying, that's why it's the catalyst. There isn't any difficulty of harmonization that it can't help you with. It knows the absolute resolution of all the tension between the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute, you know, between the isle and the eternal sun. It knows how to resolve that, absolutely. So let it adjust. See, and if you can get past the initial adjuster state and begin to move into the thought controller state, how much more of a catalyst is it going to be? So, I mean, it's like, you know, once you realize that the more you can get yourself out of the way and let it engage, it'll start doing it faster than you can even think about doing it. You've brought that absolute potential into direct juxtaposition with your process. You know, everything they're saying here, these three sections, the previous paper section and the preface and the and this first section, they're all weaving a full picture together here for you. So you can begin to see what it is that you're trying to do and how the universe initiated that process and how the universe is now adding to that and catalyzing that process. So let's see, I think that's pretty much, I think that's all that's really in there. You gotta love the little funny line there, 500 different definitions of religion. and of course, like we were just saying, you know, a key reason why that number has gotten so big is number 4, you know, in the preface there. You got all these guys with way too much thinking time on their hand thinking up, you know, new definitions, you know, and it's just not leading to clarity. It's just making the situation worse.
It's leading to a huge waste.
Since trees grow back, that's not as big a waste as wasting your mortal life, because you don't get that back. You get only one chance. And you really want to spend it ruminating on meaningless thoughts of selves? At what point do humans say, no, I don't care how many volumes that self has written. That's all the thoughts of a self. There's no clarity there, and I know it. You can judge it in an instant, because you've developed cosmic intuition. You don't just see the surface anymore. If they put up a whited sepulcher in front of you, you don't fall for that. You see all the way through it because you have the adjuster. It doesn't matter how deep they can make it. It's not infinitely deep, and I can see to infinity. I can see right through it. You can efficiently begin to separate the wheat from the chaff. I don't need to spend the next 5 years trying to wrap my mind around this thing that must say something, because every sentence I had to get the dictionary out to look up the word that this philosopher is using. I mean, that, you know, only they use, because only they know that, you know, otherwise. You know there's nothing there. Fancy words don't make truth. We need to begin to do this because it's, like they're just pointing out, it's getting really bad now. You can so easily waste your entire life because there's so many things. The internet is, you know, is well nigh infinite now. You can easily suck your whole life into that hole, you know, and do nothing. You have to be able to begin to sort. You need critical differentiation, you know, critical discernment ability. That's what the three cosmic intuitions are, right? You know, those three discriminators. Use your third cosmic intuition to discriminate. No God in this scientific theory. Therefore, that scientific theory is false. No God in this moral theory. Therefore, that moral theory is false. No God in this so-called religious theory, theology. Therefore, this theology is false. You don't even have to bring in your first cosmic intuition, your logical one. Like I was saying, you know, just recently, wait a minute, this is not logical. You know, you can penetrate around, and, you know, a lot of it can be eliminated very easily. You don't need to spend a lot of time on something that claims to be true. There's no God in it. God is the nucleus of everything. First source and center of all things and all beings. Amongst those things are ideas, theories, beliefs. They're not real if God isn't the nucleus of them. It's as simple as that. Yeah, Jason.
I think Buddhism is kind of the only one by itself.
A lot of Buddhism has natural evolutionary components, and especially if it's a facets of Buddhism that really don't have any personal God sense. In those domains of Buddhism, you don't even have very much auto-revelatory infusion of, you know, number two into it, let alone epical revelatory infusion into it. It's a very, very complex attempt to exalt, you know, the absolute, or maybe another way to think about it, you know, we were just pointing out, you know, the pure energy and the pure spirit. You know, there's a tendency for you kind of to start to focus on pure energy, you know, and it becomes, may the force be with you. You know, that's where that goes. Pure energy is the universal force.
They also have a deep appreciation for natural force, embodying those principles.
Take that whole long evolutionary tradition of that engagement with nature and the notions of divinity and deity attached to nature, you know, starting with rocks and mountains and, you know, the whole thing we went through. You have that whole history, and then they're taking this higher philosophic consciousness and they're trying to rationalize that. You know, and it's like, well, it's not just rocks. It's exalted rocks. And they're trying to somehow satisfy, you know, that sense of, it has to be something profound, you know. How did they word that? Every intelligent creature gives the name of God to the best and highest thing he knows. And so they've done that. It goes up really high, but there's no God. And like they're just pointing out, a religionist can have a very simplistic, you know, highly anthropomorphic, actual personal notion, you know, true God notion. And that trumps all of that fancy philosophy about the absolute in an instant. The guy with the gray beard and the magic wand just obliterates that. You know, that just, again, shows you the power of personal spiritual experience to cut through, you know, the most elaborate rationalization schemes that the human mind can dream up.
While your religion is a matter of personal experience, it is most important that you should be exposed to the knowledge of a vast number of other religious experiences, the diverse interpretations of other and diverse mortals, to the end that you may prevent your religious life from becoming egocentric, circumscribed, selfish, and unsocial. Rationalism is wrong when it assumes that religion is at first a primitive belief in something, which is then followed by the pursuit of values. Religion is primarily a pursuit of values, and then there formulates a system of interpretive beliefs. It is much easier for men to agree on religious values, goals, than on beliefs, interpretations. And this explains how religion can agree on values and goals while exhibiting the confusing phenomenon of maintaining a belief in hundreds of conflicting beliefs, creeds. This also explains why a given person can maintain his religious experience in the face of giving up or changing many of his religious beliefs. Religion persists in spite of revolutionary changes in religious beliefs. Theology does not produce religion. It is religion that produces theologic philosophy.
Let's picture that, you know, in the threefold here, going to get us in step, because the final paragraph in this section is wanting you to really engage the threefold pattern again. See, so notice how carefully they word that. You know, like I've tried to point out, remember the things that are on the chart here are just your foundation points in the threefold character upon which you impose unity through personality. You know, they're pointing out that religion is the pursuit of values first. You have ideas, you know, related to individuality, and science is a system of ideas. You have associations of ideas and philosophy, like for instance theology, is a system of those associations of ideas. But in its basic foundational character, what, you know, you have ideals, and religion is the system of ideals. Ideal values. You know, the pursuit of values. You are compelled, drawn to ideals, to move those ideas towards unity so that you can overcome the limitations of the individuality that is inherent in ideas. You know, it's just tied to values, ideals. You know, it's a system of ideals. That's what it starts out as. You know, especially, you know, in a real progressing natural context. You know, Revelation tends to bring in a heavy dose of personality. You begin to go beyond ideas, associations, and ideals, and you start to really bring in harmony. After ideals is harmony, and the system of harmony, that's moda. Well, we don't have moda consciousness because we're not Maranja beings. So, you know, what makes up for that? Revelation. The more you bring in revelation, the more, you know, you begin to have that fullness of ideas and ideals in the full harmonized threefold system. You know, we'll see as we go forward. That's just the starting point. Personality doesn't just do that. It does everything. Personality brings in everything. What you really want to do to start this process up is get a firm grip on knowledge, on science, get a firm grip on values, and then the association, that relationship between science and religion is philosophy. That's where belief is. You know, belief is in this associative block. You know, you start with that, and then beliefs come second, as they should, because beliefs are about that associative domain, which literally can't exist unless there's the two endpoints first. You know, you can't associate one thing. Initially, mind is just the relationship between the two substances, matter and spirit. You know, it's the relationship between individuality and unity. So as actuality, it's just that. Personality comes in and imposes itself on the whole system, and this block in the middle is not so much a simple linear association, a simple relationship, but you get a true superadditive phenomenon happening there. You know, your personality engages that superadditive whole. You know, as we've really gotten into them talking about what is true religion, you remember we pointed that out. You know, they were trying to make it clear that personality can't really engage just part of the picture, because it's coming from the first source and center, where there are no parts. It's a pattern from the pre-part whole. It really can't engage until you begin to have a wholeness of actuality that it can then realize. You impose pattern upon purpose and make it real. you know, the easiest way to think about what it's doing is it's engaging the superadditive center of the threefold relationship. You take a lot of the concepts in this associative block, like truth, and you understand that now in its full superadditive character, so that, you know, the personality is a truth seeker. You know, that's really the core of the phenomenon. You're not first a fact finder or a goodness finder. In the process of seeking cosmic truth, you know, that full superadditive whole of the, you know, the truth of it, you will find fact and goodness. You know, you see that if you look at the way they talk about this in the book. That's when they're speaking in that full personal context, they're always using things in the center here, like morality. They'll often point out how that is your initial kind of anchor point on a whole, the full true superadditive moral consciousness. But you have to, you know, recognize that we've gone beyond the simple here, and we've brought in this, which makes the whole thing a unity. When you have the spirit of truth liberated, it makes mighty contributions to the enlargement of the human capacity to perceive religious truths. You know, you have to remember, don't just think of it as merely the spirit of truth. It's also the spirit of unification. And if you go back and look when they're talking about the bestowal of the spirit of truth, and they sort of introduce the facts of the nature of it, you notice there's two parts to that statement. The part that is directly related to calling it the spirit of truth, and the second part that's directly related to calling it the spirit of unification. The first incredibly profound way that it serves as the spirit of unification is linking your lowly, highly sangic, you know, adjutant state down here, and maybe just the seventh psychic circle, you know, that lowest cosmic level, unifying that with the adjuster, you know, which we know without the assistance of that spirit of unification to bridge the gap, to bridge between time and eternity, the adjuster can't reach you until you get up to the third circle. You got to move way up in cosmic character, because it can only reach down that far. When you have the spirit of unification, it can come in right away, reach all the way down to basically, you know, third level. You're down there at the seventh, you know, as a six-year-old, dawning on that first level, and it bridges the gap. And slowly as you move up, less and less of that very simple, factual unification ministry, you know, is needed. Once you get up to being a third circler, you know, you don't need it to bridge that simple aspect of the gap anymore. It's going to bridge higher and higher gaps. But, you know, it plays a huge role initially, see, as a spirit of unification, so that you can get an adjuster as a six-year-old. Incredibly glorious gift.
That religionists have believed so much that was false does not invalidate religion, because religion is founded on the recognition of values and is validated by the faith of personal religious experience. Religion, then, is based on experience and religious thought. Theology, the philosophy of religion, is an honest attempt to interpret that experience. Such interpretive beliefs may be right or wrong, or a mixture of truth and error.
Notice how they're getting you to reflect on two parts, truth and error, more the actuality, right and wrong, more the reality. But then now see what they do in this final paragraph. This is just a glorious combination of prose and poetry.
The realization of the recognition of spiritual values is an experience which is super-ideational. There is no word in any human language which can be employed to designate this sense, feeling, intuition, or experience which we have elected to call God consciousness. The spirit of God that dwells in man is not personal. The adjuster is pre-personal. But this monitor presents a value, exudes a flavor of divinity, which is personal in the highest and infinite sense. If God were not at least personal, he could not be conscious, and if not conscious, then he would be infrahuman.
Okay. Now, this paragraph is really magnificent. We've got to spend a little time talking about this, because this is a great example of how, you know, they're wanting to give you a big sweeping picture, but there is just incredible precision of choice of words. This is the thing that they're just, you know, unbelievable masters at. So notice how it starts out. The realization of the recognition of spiritual values. Think about how we've been kind of moving from the, you know, the real foundational aspects of the threefold pattern. You know, you start with matter, mind, spirit, you know, just the quantitative. And you move up to things, meanings, and values, the qualitative. You know, we've talked about how, you know, you move up, you build in this chart. When you're talking about things, meanings, values, when you bring in personality, then you have reality. When you see, you know, the realization of the recognition of spiritual values. Here, you've recognized spiritual values. You know, you bring in personality, and now you realize it. You know, that sentence, you should see it, you know, in the pattern here, what they're saying. Then they say, there is no word in any human language can be employed to designate this sense, feeling, intuition, or experience which we have elected to call God consciousness. Okay, what they're pointing out there is what I was just alluding to. When you bring in the fullness of personality, this whole thing becomes one. You lift this up to a much higher level. And that's what that final field in this chart is all about. Number 7 there. When you go to admiration of beauty, belief in truth, reverence of goodness, and faith in God, who is love. You know, if you want to understand what that final block is about, or that final field in the blocks is about, it's what comes into play in the fullness of personality, expression. Notice, for instance, one of the simple things that you see. You know, we started out just talking just about the actuality. We talked about fact, truth, and goodness. I've got truth and goodness repeated here. Reuse of the same word like that is trying to remind you of what's going on. You're taking that which, you know, starts out as just kind of just the actuality of what you're working with, and you're going to lift it all up. This is truth in the full personal context, you know, the real context, reality. Remember, that's what we're talking about, the realization. We're not just talking about the actuality of truth and goodness. It's not just the fact of it, or the thingness of it, or I mean, you know, that hence, you know, it's a phrase here. And this one's a great example, and this relates to what Jason was bringing up about art. See, art does not exist without personality. Because beauty doesn't exist without personality. Without personality, all there is fact. So you have fact, truth, goodness. When you exalt it, notice you don't have fact, truth, goodness. You have beauty, truth, goodness. A person can lift facts up into beauty. The art, there can be an artist that makes art out of facts. An artist is a person. You know, when you see, you know, how debased this has become because it's so sad to record, you know, we've begun to forget what many long ago recognized. The Greeks, you know, really getting a consciousness of beauty, you know, during that spiritual quickening back in the 6th century B.C. It's a personality quickening because it's a spiritual quickening. You know, one of the facets of that full personal consciousness, beauty, becomes alive like it never was before. And there's art, finally, true art, not just mimicking in nature in a mechanical way and, you know, and all these sorts of anthropomorphic, simple sorts of things, but a true consciousness of art, beauty, the beauty that is a facet of God. These now are all one. You know, no longer do you have three blocks or even four blocks. We know that God, see, God consciousness, like they're just pointing, God consciousness has these three things in it. You know, the beauty and the truth and the goodness of God are one in the love of God. Notice how clever. See, when they're trying to say there's no word. Why is there no word? Because we've never coined words that reflect the whole thing together. We have words that point to parts. You can have a sense of beauty. You can have a feeling of truth. You can have an intuition of goodness, and you can have a faith experience. But what is it like when it's all together as one? What they're calling God consciousness. There's not a word for it. So they have to give you all four words in quotes. Try to see them come together as one. Now we know that the adjuster is not personal. The adjuster is often spoken of as pure spirit. And universal force, the force charge of space, is spoken of as pure energy. But both of those directly come from the first source, in which there is no distinction between energy and spirit. Those are really one and the same thing. And not only that, but they're both personal ministries of the Universal Father. It's like, well, wait a minute. I mean, if it's not personal, then what does this mean, you know, that it is personal in the highest and infinite sense? And this is where you have to challenge yourself to go beyond the finite in your thought. You've got to go beyond the distinction between energy and spirit and their mediation through mind. Because the first source and center is beyond that. If you're going to begin to contemplate the nature of the first source and center, you have to transcend that limited viewpoint. In the Father, the pure energy and the pure spirit are one. Like I tried to point out, I mean, literally, that's one ministry, not two ministries. It's one ministry. If you take all the adjusters that are pure energy, you turn them around, you have the force charge of space. They're the same thing. They cannot be separate because they come from that which is the inseparable fact at the core of all things. They are one and the same thing. And not only that, like we've talked about, see, when we have the threefold actuality and you bring in personality, it begins to create harmonies, begins to weave that threefold actuality together into a harmony. So the personality is that harmonizing influence on that system. Well, there's nothing to harmonize in the first source and center. It's singular, one. Personality means a lot more than it, you know, than we can imagine it means. I mean, it is innately one with the actuality. The reality and the actuality are one. The reality, you know, is not the influence that's harmonizing the actuality. You know, in the first source and center, the potentiality, the actuality, and the reality are one. You know, when you use the word personal for the Universal Father, you're only using it in a relational sense. Because the fact of what the first source and center is transcends all these words. It transcends matter, mind, spirit, and personality. None of those words really apply literally anymore. And that's related to that last sentence. If God were not at least personal, he could not be conscious. Okay, you should go, wait a minute. No. I know that my consciousness is in my mind. I mean, animals are conscious. They have minds. They don't need personalities to be conscious. So what do they say? Oh, wait a minute. That's right. I forgot. There's one exception to this whole thing. When I'm talking about the first source and center, there's no mind there because there's no matter and spirit separated there. All is one. And all is personal, you know, in the sense of infinite harmony. Like they alluded to, that infinite supremacy, that soul of infinite supremacy, you know, that phrase that they used. You have to remind yourself about some of these technical issues. And, I mean, there is intense level of precision and technical demand that the revelators impose upon you with this one little simple paragraph. You have to contemplate the transcendent character of the first source and center, and on. Even in the final phrase there, then would he be infrahuman? The prefix infra means below, but so does the prefix sub. Why didn't they say subhuman? Like they do every other place in the book. Never ever are they using a thesaurus, remember? Never ever are they saying, well, we've used subhuman a lot of times, let's just use infrahuman this time. You know, so we're not so repetitive. Never ever ever are they doing that. They very purposely said infrahuman here in this one instance in the entire book because they wanted to distinguish what they were talking about here to what they used the word subhuman for. Subhuman is used in the context of the adjutants, of mind, where you have anything up to the first five adjutants, that's subhuman. If you have all seven, that's human. And if you just have six and seven, that's superhuman, like midwares. That's the way they've chosen to use the prefix sub relative to human, is in that mindal context. We're talking about the first source and center here. It's no mind. So they can't use sub. So they purposely use a different prefix. You know, and you say, well, I mean, it's such a mind. What difference does it make? But see, that's the beauty. They are never, even the most slightest bit sloppy about this. They're intensely precise. To say subhuman here would be to break the truth of the whole revelation. You know, it work. It has to fit perfectly. Technically, you can't say subhuman here. You've got to use a different word. And so they purposely use infra. Just like we have infrared, you know, below red in energy level. It's infrahuman. That's why. Again, like I said, because there's no mind here. We're talking about the first source and center. We're talking about something that is conscious only because it's personal. When you're on the Isle of Paradise, the whole phenomenon of relating to things is fundamentally volitional, personal. See, because you're beginning to transcend all of the separateness of this. It's all one, and it is personal. Personality is the essence of that oneness. That you are then to an adequate degree to have experiences there. And of course, the more you move from the outer areas towards the center in the deity presence, the more that true that is.